Hey, everybody. This is the TV podcast. We're talking about a show that hasn't even aired yet, but the first episode appeared, and we thought we would talk about it because, well, frankly, I was really excited about the Expanse series of books, some of the best books I think that I've read in the last 5 years, best sci-fi series, and I really enjoyed the pilot episode, which was made available for free on YouTube and sci-fi.com and iTunes, and so I wanted to see if anybody wanted to talk about it, and of course it's The Incomparable, so people say yes to talking about things because that is who these people are. It's a rare podcast network that is full of people who refuse to speak. So let me introduce the people who are here to talk about the pilot episode of Sci-Fi's The Expanse. And I will say up front, we are not going to talk about what happens in the other four books of the series until the end, when we will warn you and you can hide if you haven't read any of the books or have only read the first one. Here with me, David J. Lohr. Hello.
Hello there.
Erica Ensign.
Hello. I should point out that it is not actually available on iTunes in Canada. So, you know, thank goodness for YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube also available. Aline Sims. Hi.
Hello.
Taking a break from talking about Jessica Jones.
I am. A brief one.
Brief break. Dan Morin.
Howdy.
And Joseph Rosensteel. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
That's his move.
It is.
I'm telling you, he's an AI.
That's what he does. Hi. How's it going?
I didn't really have any, like, a spiffy quote.
So have all of us read Leviathan Wakes? I think we have. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right. So we will talk later about perhaps some things about how this book has been adapted to a TV show in specific. But right now, I think my first order of business is to go around and get some initial thoughts about the episode in general and how you're feeling about it. Did you like the episode, and did it make you excited for the series? Because there are more nine more episodes where this came from. So let's go around and get first impressions about this first episode. It's all about first impressions. Joe, hi. How about you?
Hi. I liked it overall, but I have nitpicks, of which to pick, I'm sure, later. While I'm looking forward to it, I'm kind of not sure how it's going to pan out compared to the book, at least in terms of setting and pace and stuff. But we can get to that.
All right. Dan?
Yes, I too enjoyed this episode. It is very weird to come into it from the perspective of having read the books and knowing kind of what's going to happen. But then again, I also read the first book well over a year ago at this point. So, like Scott McNulty, my memory of what happened in that book is sometimes kind of hazy.
Oh, yeah.
But overall, I was a big fan of it. Like Joe, I probably have some nitpicks, but, certainly where the first episode leaves off, I don't feel like I could exactly stop watching right there.
Aline?
I'm so excited, which is very uncharacteristic for me. I usually watch a first episode of something, especially something based on a property that I know already, and I kind of feel iffy about it. And at the end of this episode, I was like, okay, I'm ready for the next one. Why
right
are you
now.
Not Netflix? Why can I not binge this? So I'm super excited. I do have nitpicks. I wouldn't be a nerd if I didn't have nitpicks, but I'm really, really stoked for the rest of the series.
I'm sensing some foreshadowing here of some nitpicking to happen later in this episode.
Lies.
Erica, what are your thoughts about this?
I think I may have taken over Aline's usual response. I did read the book, but it hasn't been as long ago as it was for Dan, but I still actually found that I didn't remember it as well as I kind of thought. And I was overall kind of meh on this episode. If I hadn't read the books, I'm not sure I would continue watching it. And I have read the books and I'm still not sure I'm going to continue watching it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And some more foreshadowing there. Erica will really enjoy the nitpicking to come. David, what do you think?
I liked it. I mean, again, I was ready to binge watch the next episode or two at least. And if nothing else, I have to say, I'm glad to see actual science fiction on Sci-Fi Channel again.
Well, there's that.
I know.
It's been a while.
Between this and Childhood's, and they know the programmers at Sci-Fi got the message. I think it's new programmers, and they decided that this was their brand, and no matter how
science fiction is their brand.
No matter how they spell it, because they don't spell it right, but they've realized that they kind of lost touch with some of the with their brand, and so they are trying to have real sci-fi content on the Sci-Fi Channel. Imagine that, instead of it being reality shows about people who think they see ghosts. So
and wrestling,
it's yeah,
wrestling.
So
those
it's,
are basically the same thing, David.
Yeah, the ghosts. You don't see the ghosts, but the wrestlers do. So so I agree, and I'm sort of with Aline here. I was very excited. I was enthusiastic about the series, but I figured, you know, it'll get here at the end of the year, and you know, that'll be great. And then I watched the pilot, and I was much more excited about the series, because although nitpick foreshadowing to come, agreed, the all in all, I had that moment of like, you know, how often does it happen that you see an ambitious and capable, you know, space series, and especially it's a space series that is telling a story set in our solar system rather than it being a Star Trek clone or something mm-hmm. like that. It seems like a fairly rare commodity to me, and so I was excited that they were doing this and trying to keep the, you know, trying to keep the science fairly accurate, which is also true in the books. So I was also enthusiastic about that part of it, that this is, you know, not something we get a lot of, and we haven't gotten a while. And I'm not going to compare this to Battlestar Galactica, but I did have that moment where it's like, hey, yeah, remember when there were, you know, scenes like this on the Sci-Fi Channel? That was like back when Battlestar Galactica was on. It's been a while.
And the other thing that was giving me a little trepidation ahead of time was everyone was saying, oh, this is going to be like the Game of Thrones in outer space. It's like the science fiction Game of Thrones, right? And as people who have listened to Inconceivable will know, I don't watch Game of Thrones. I don't read Game of Thrones. And that was immediately like, oh, I don't know if I want to watch that. I want to watch that. I want to keep going.
I think the main comparison there is to the scope, right? I mean, there are, especially as this pilot is structured, there are a lot of different plot threads. There are a lot of characters. In far-flung locations. Some of them don't even appear in the actual first book. Mm. And so, you know, having to follow that, I think that's what you're sort of comparing it to in Game of Thrones, which was itself compared to, like, The Wire. So this is like The Wire in space.
And the theory being that, you know, it'll be approximately a book per season. So they say.
I can't even think. How do you get through that?
I can't do the math, but we'll get there. We'll get there after we blow the spoiler horn. To try and figure that one out. I suspect one of the reasons they talked about this as the Game of Thrones in space is just because Ty Frank is one of the two authors of the books, and he is George R. R. Martin's assistant, and learned, I think, a lot, but has outdone his boss in the sense that they put these books out 1 year after another. They're reliable, you know, super solid, well done, and every year, every June, there's a new book. So there's no fear that they're going to run out of story for this series, because not only do they have five books, but they keep on adding more books every year. So, but
they don't have an end point in mind either, do they?
I don't know. I get the sense that they've got sort of like a big story arc that they're working toward, but they keep sort of adding blocks as they go. And again, we'll talk about that more a lot later. So it's got the three settings, and that is one way where it does remind one of Game of Thrones a little bit. You know, it's ambitious book adaptation. It's got lots of characters, and it's got these three settings. I suppose we should take them in turn and talk about them individually. I mean, the plot of the episode, I'm not gonna recap it here. It is literally the first three chapters of the book or something like that. It is it's really about these three settings. So we'll break it down that way. Let's start with Earth, only because that's kind of interesting in that is material that isn't in the books, but is in the TV series. And it features a character who appears in book two originally in the series, but they brought her forward because she's an important character. And I think they feel like human Earther TV viewers, which is 100% of the sci-fi audience, so far as we know, people who live on planet Earth, probably want to see a little human Earth perspective on this instead of just the outer space stuff. So
I'm so glad to hear you say that that was not in the first book, because I was like, wow, I did not remember this part at all. I thought I'd completely forgotten about it, and I haven't read beyond the first book, so I'm glad to know that I wasn't completely losing my mind during those scenes, which I actually enjoyed.
And there's really not much even there in the pilot as far as Earth scenes, right? There's only two, maybe three scenes. I think it's only two.
Two plus Avasarala is on the background in the news.
And she's also, I think, will anyone disagree with me if I say the best character from the series?
No. I let out a shriek when I saw her. I was like, yes, because I was prepared to go the whole first season without seeing her. So when I saw her, I was like, yes, this is the best thing.
And this is Shura.
I will agree she's the best character on the show.
Yeah.
Wow.
The thing I'm worried about is that, like, she's... this is maybe a slight spoiler, but she's really salty in the books. Like, she's got a mouth on her, and they're not going to be able to do that on sci-fi. So I'm a little bit like, I'm wondering what they're going to do with her.
I don't know. We had some sex in the first episode too.
But they have a little more language leeway.
Yeah, they do. It's basic cable.
Post Watershed.
Yeah. It's a 10 o'clock show. And you have a certain, I mean, if you watched Mad Men live on AMC when it aired, if you watched, Breaking Bad, I mean, they can get away with certain words and a certain number of them. If you have, like, more than three or four, they might start bleeping you. But you can do,
like, a sentence?
Yeah, because Aline's right. She's got a sentence where she does three or four.
Right.
you can probably get away with a
this
couple.
This isn't broadcast, it's cable.
The South Park where Cartman said, you know... How many four-letter words in half an hour? Something like 130 or something.
Hopefully they won't tone it down too much, because that is a big part of her character. And it's kind of hard in these first few couple scenes to really get a good idea. They clearly set her up with these two dynamic opposites, right? The scenes for her.
She's a doting grandmother who is taking care of her grandchild, and her husband comes in and you know, it's all smiles, and then they take her off to the black site on Long Island Hampton's Island, because of course the sea levels have risen, so New York is sort of submerged, where she basically is interrogating a subject who's being tortured. So we get the nice contrast there.
Which I will say, that reminded me of when I lived on Long Island. So that's true.
Were you tortured on Long Island, David?
No, I just lived there. So same thing.
So click.
I will say that was a nice, I thought that establishing shot, especially when they do the flyby of the Statue of Liberty and it's kind of sunken in. I had that moment of like, what's going
around it?
Oh, that's the crazy and futuristic. And then I'd like put it together, like that all the sea level had risen. I'm like, that's actually, you know, not really talked about in the book, but it was a nice bit of sort of world building and illustration.
Scott McNulty said he thought it was the best future New York he'd seen.
Yeah, it was cool because they do like the job like laying in all those other buildings. Yeah. You know, it looked recognizable and yet distinct.
Yeah, I really like what they did there with the effects. It's not over the top. We're not going through every little city block or anything, but we get a sense of what's happened with the world that we know.
Yeah, it's anything else about Earth? I mean, Avasarala, yeah, a very popular character, doesn't appear until the second book. They pulled her forward because she is important later. And rather than, again, they could have cast an actor for that part in season two, but they brought her forward. It'll be interesting to see how they use that character, because that's the stuff that's going to be, I assume, you know, I would say they're going to manufacture things for her to do, but I think it's more going to be, we're going to get a different angle on some of the things that happen in this story, an additional angle, because there is, you know, there are lots of political ramifications that happen in this story, and having somebody from an Earth perspective to show that to us is probably helpful. I reread the book after watching the pilot, because I didn't remember lots of things, and it is striking that it's the perspective is entirely from our other two points of view, essentially, and not from Earth. So I think that's effective to have her.
I did think they did a really good job of showing like these two very separate aspects of her character that we kind of don't get to know until later on in things like right from the get-go. You see her with her grandchild and like tickling him and, you know, like, oh, you're going to make him pee. And she's like, so what? And then, you know, to this she immediately goes from that scene to like torturing a guy. And these kind of desperate aspects of her personality and like what she sees as, I don't know, like being right or being necessary for whatever it is that she's doing.
Little known fact, if that guy doesn't give up the information, she's going to tickle
him. Tickle him, yeah.
Totally peace.
To the tickler with you.
I am kind of concerned, though, with how they're going to weave her into what the other characters are doing, because it'd be kind of a shame if she just stayed on Earth for the whole entire first season. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely so. They presumably need to give her some things to do. So we'll
torture, tickle, play with grandkids.
Yeah.
Not much of an arc in there.
But not just things to do with other people on Earth, though. She's going to have to meet our other main characters, but it's going to be interesting to see how they choose to do that, because since she is absent from the original series.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if she'll actually meet the other characters or not. We'll have to see if they insert her to that degree, or whether she continues to be just seen in the background on TV by the other characters.
she's just a teaser throughout this whole first season.
She's doing well. In book two, you definitely, again, not spoiling anything here, you get the sense that she was actually active during the actions that happened in the first book. We just never saw it because she wasn't a viewpoint character, and she was only, I think, not even referenced. And if referenced, never seen in the book. And so that's the question here is presumably what they're going to do is show, you know, what this character was doing during the events of the first book of the first season of the show. But so let's move on from Earth and tickling and torturing and let's go to the belt, and we'll go to let's go to the Canterbury, and we'll talk about the crew of the Canterbury. And in this episode we meet the crew of the Canterbury, which is an ice hauler. These are your long haul truckers, of your ice road truckers, where they're taking ice from Saturn's rings and bringing it to the asteroid belt, and in this case they're headed to Ceres with their payload, and essentially they get a distress signal. The captain tries to get them to purge it from their logs so that they don't have to follow it, because he thinks it's suspicious and it's just going to be pirates, and even if it's nothing, it's going to slow them down. But acting executive officer, acting second in command, has a fit of a pang of conscience and restores the item so that it gets sent back to home base and they're ordered to check it out. And then really bad things happen. they discover the ship that we see in the teaser of the episode, where a mysterious woman who is revealed to be Julie Mao, once we go to Ceres, is being held captive and then escapes, and there's nobody on the ship, and she goes to the engine room and sees something blue and glowy and creepy with human forms in it, and she screams, and then that's it for that. And then these guys go there to investigate and find the same ship. They're told that a ship that they were certain wasn't anywhere nearby before is actually moving nearby. They rush out of the ship to their little shuttle, and missiles are launched, and they think that they're all going to die. But in fact, the missiles go past them to the Canterbury and blow it up, killing everybody on board. At which point my wife turned to me and said, "But I thought the show was about those people." And I said,
"Oh no,
nope. It's about the ones in the shuttle."
I have to comment. Yeah, speaking of side characters who are unimportant, I liked the one place, at least that I read, they called this the Jonathan Banks series, The Expanse.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
because he appears in
one scene.
and in fact, like, you know, I remember seeing him in the trailer too, and trying to figure out like, who the hell is he playing? Like, as it turns out,
he's crazy, and I don't think he's talking to his plants in the dirt.
And I don't think he's in the
not in the
he's
book.
Not he's no. maybe mentioned, because Holden is the acting XO, as I recall.
I don't know.
But,
I think if anything, it's
all off screen.
Yeah. Yep.
So yeah, bizarre choice to have that character. I guess we're supposed to take something away from that. It's lonely. there in space.
And you can be driven mad. But I'll have Lauren play the part of what Steven does in the Audio Guide to Babylon 5, somebody who doesn't know anything about it and is just watching it with fresh eyes. She was completely convinced that this was going to be the adventures of the ice hauler, the crew of the ice hauler Canterbury.
Yes. And it's just an entire season of getting ice.
And they'll have an adventure, right? And we met the captain and we learned a little about him and we met Holden's girlfriend and we learned a little about her, that she's like, look, you need to not turn down jobs because of me, because I'm on a contract and then I'm out of here. You know, we got to know with the guy who lost his arm, but he's got the awesome prosthetic that he doesn't want that stuff, the drops that they have back on Earth that grow you a new arm. He wants a Belter prosthetic instead. It's a ragtag crew. And then they blow up.
It is a nice bit of bait and switch.
I'm glad that you got Lauren to sort of be that perspective. I actually did watch it with my spouse, Steven, who knows nothing about the books at all. But when I asked him at the end, what did you think? He was just kind of like, meh, it's all right. My time is precious.
He has an interesting perspective on things.
Yeah. His other comment was, a lot of white dudes flying around in space in the future. I was like, well, yes, you have a point.
They're more, we will talk about casting in a bit. They're not all white dudes, but there are a lot of white dudes in space. Mm-hmm, this is true. Mm-hmm. That's true. More than I thought in my own little brain casting of the books.
Yep.
So I have a problem with that. But we'll get to that. What else do people think about the spaceship stuff before we get to the asteroid stuff? Other things about? I mean, I guess we could talk about the casting now about the crew of the shuttle. The people who didn't die on the Canterbury, especially. Oh, by the way, there's a Ned Stark moment here where just before it blows up, Holden's girlfriend says there's something you should know, and then the ship blows up. And I just thought that was really funny.
I'll tell you about your mother when you come back.
When you come back later. So the casting. So for me, the big casting surprise here is that I don't know if this is in the book or not, but I always pictured. Oh, now I'm gonna totally space on it. Somebody else. 24 minutes. Somebody else. What do you think about casting?
Okay,
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Aline.
Okay, so I thought Alex was black.
He's Indian.
I always
Alex
him.
Kamal.
Okay, yeah. Well, but the Mars, you know, like the Mars melting pot that, you know, we kind of learn about later. I was like, you know.
Right, but that was my understanding is that there are lots of black people and lots of Indian people on Mars.
Yeah. Yes. I thought Amos looked kind of like Mr. Clean. I pictured Balder, not just buzz cut, but like Balder and like really muscular.
Big.
Yeah. And yeah. he's you know, he's not huge like I pictured him.
I'll go you one better with Amos. I always cast, and this is not an actor who is alive, but I always cast a Michael Clark Duncan type as Amos. I wanted him to be tough black guy from Baltimore. Tough black guy from Baltimore. And then I see this guy, and it's just the white guy with a sort of a southernish accent. And I'm like, what? That's Amos? Really?
He should have been. He should be big. The physicality of him is so important. He's supposed to be a giant hulking guy.
Knowing from the plot of the book in general, which again, for the first episode, you're not noticing, but it was surprising to me, and I thought that was an opportunity for some diversity that was lost by having a white guy's Amos, because we're talking about a tough guy from Baltimore. Why can't that be a black actor?
That guy still needs to sell me too, because that is a tough role. And we haven't seen enough of him yet to know whether or not he can convincingly pull that off. Mm-hmm. Beyond just the whole issue of race. I think that's an extremely difficult role that requires a lot of subtlety, and I'm not sure whether or not this guy's up to it. But yeah, that's definitely the most problematic of all of them I found.
I agree.
Yeah, I felt like since I didn't remember the book too well, I tried to just, and even if I had remembered the book, I would try to go in looking at it just as a television show and I always try to divorce myself from the original material as much as possible. And this time it was way easy. But I felt we had so little time with any of the characters that none of them on the ship really stuck, except, the XO was pretty much the only one. And then, right. I don't know character names, but the black woman.
Yeah, Naomi.
Naomi,
yes. And I liked her simply because she was a woman, and I'm always drawn to the characters who are, you know, the rare females in the cast. So those are the only two that I actually paid much attention to. Everybody else only had like a handful of lines each. Right. So I wasn't really able to make form any opinions about them, since I don't really remember the book that well.
In the Game of Thrones parallel, it is difficult when you have this many characters and this much stuff happening in 1 hour to have a lot of character moments. And that's a challenge for this, because you were trying to introduce people to these characters and they don't get a lot of time. We get a little bit of Alex. He's kind of a laid back Wash from Firefly kind of guy a little bit, I think.
My one complaint about him, as is going to be my complaint about most of the people here, is that he's just too handsome to be Alex, who is always, in my mind, he's like thinning hair, schlubby, slightly overweight, but like cheerful and everything. And it's like, I mean, you know, what can you do? You're going to cast a handsome person because it's not the BBC. Television. And that guy he's still one of the better, you know, I think, like closer portrayals. Holden is weird because Holden is kind of an everyman. I expected, in my head, he's always a little bit older and a little bit more movie starish, even in one way. Like, he's supposed to be very, like, personable, very charismatic. And this guy, well, fine, hasn't really evidenced that charisma yet. Like, would you follow this guy into all the situations that people follow Holden into? I don't think so.
Like a younger George Clooney.
This guy's a drip.
Yeah.
Yeah, without going into any much detail about what's coming next. But I mean, Holden, it doesn't go far to say Holden is one of the main characters of the show. And so it's a fair question. I think there's a nice moment with Naomi and Holden where she says something about if his girlfriend is the one who got that distress signal put back in the log, she's going to be in trouble. And he says to her, no, it was me. And she gives him a look and says, you know, basically, you better not say that to anyone else. And I thought that was a nice moment where she's got her own agenda and she is judging him sort of, but she's also not telling on him. So I don't know. I thought there was enough of an exchange there, and that we see that she's competent and she's running the show with him on that on the shuttle.
But with Naomi, I kind of thought she was almost a little more polished than I had pictured in my mind, just from, you know, like having a Belcher patois and all that. Like, she just seemed a little more put together than maybe I had read into it.
Yeah, head casting versus actual casting. It's hard. You get to cast whoever you want, and also, if there is an actor, like, one of the challenges with this is that there's a lot of mixed race characters in the books, and it is harder, I would imagine, to cast mixed race actors because there are, just in society, there are more people who are not mixed race than are. And I had that moment with Naomi where it's like, I think that that's an interesting bit of casting. Her last name is Nagata. I really expected her to be an Asian actor or a partially Asian actress. And instead she is black, which is fine, but not what I expected. And like I said, Amos, I expected that Naomi would be Asian, Amos would be black, Alex would be Indian. And that's not quite what I got. But I appreciate the fact that casting is hard and finding the right actors at the right ages for the roles, and that you may end up finding somebody who's really good who isn't your initial concept, but still it didn't match the casting that I was able to do with unlimited imagination in my head and instead of real actors who are available.
Yeah, I mean, again, the age thing was the other part. I still feel like Holden strikes me as too young.
I had that
exact
same thought.
There's a young pretty thing here, right?
I was like, either he's too young or I have just reached that age where in media everybody's younger than I am. I just can't handle it. Well, so I'm shaking my cane at the television.
So part of it is also you've got Thomas Jane as Miller back on series, which we'll
also
talk about.
Too young.
And but I feel like if you cast Thomas Jane, then they actually want somebody to counterbalance that. Who's going to be, because Thomas Jane is Gasp Sci-Fi Channel 46 years old, right?
Yeah, see, he feels more like Holden to me, honestly.
Yes.
Like,
he's
got that sort of chiseled face and he's a little bit older, but
he's too pretty.
Yeah, I mean,
he is too
but
pretty,
like Holden is supposed to be too pretty. Like that's what everybody, you know.
Right, which is why I feel like he would be better as
no,
Holden.
I agree.
Yeah.
Call up the Sci-Fi Channel. I demand they change all the casting.
Swap him out.
He's also supposed to have like a washed up military
career.
Because
Holden is 29. Yeah.
Yeah.
It must have been a very sudden
prodigal.
Early washout.
Well, and one thing that's interesting, you know, you can sort of say, well, you know, they did a weird job of casting and everything, but the authors are actually producers and in the writer's room on this, so they must mm-hmm. be okay with it. Even if they don't love
fine.
It, but they must be okay with it.
It's an adaptation, right? Like, you know, it's never going to be, like we were saying, it's never going to be the way it is in your head. And I'm sure I will give all these people a chance. It's just, I think it's indicative of, at least for most of us, it sounds like, how much we identified and liked the characters in this show, that we all have such, like, vivid, like, descriptive images of them in our heads. I don't get that for every book I read. Hmm. But for this book, it is really... I feel like those characters are built up over the course of those series that you have a really good picture of them.
Erica,
you'll
be happy to know that the actor who plays Alex Kamal is Canadian.
Ooh. I think they're all Canadian.
A lot of them are Canadian because it's shot in Vancouver. But he is
Toronto.
A Iranian descent.
Is it shot in Vancouver or is it in Toronto?
Space.
Toronto.
Shot in space.
Oh, in Toronto.
Because there was,
it doesn't matter because we can't see any trees.
True. The one guy who didn't keep the air filters clean on the station, as soon as his first scene was over,
Toronto.
Steven was like, oh, they shot it in Toronto because that guy
that's
is
Toronto.
In every single Toronto show.
That's
Toronto because of that guy.
I will say counterpoint there. He also appears, fans of Supernatural will recognize him as Death. He plays Death on that, which is shot in Vancouver. So he's bi-coastal.
I guess so.
Look at that. Well, so he's one coastal.
To talk
Toronto's
about the,
not on a coast.
To talk about the space, well, it's in the general region of the East. I think is what Dan meant by that.
Not in Canada, it's not.
he's bilingual. No, wait.
It's like by Buffalo, New York is like
yeah.
That
Canada
is
goes
there's
so
a lot
much
more Canada.
Farther east.
There's
we
a lot
don't.
More
states does we don't. It doesn't.
You
no,
know, we don't count.
We have another entire time zone. Actually, two entire new time zones.
I'm aware
Stop
of
bragging.
You know, I work with Jim Dalrymple for years. I know of the Atlantic time zone well.
If he shoots a series on PEI, now you're talking.
Yeah, the East Coast bias is different in Canada.
Canada effects.
We should probably say something about the set design on the spaceships and stuff, the effects, which I thought were pretty good. I like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
A little worried when I saw the...
Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say, I was a little worried when I saw the promotional photos initially circulate that it looked a little Babylon 5-ish, which is not a knock on Babylon 5. It's just that we've gone, you know, like 20 years since then, so I would hope it would be a little better. But the... It's a little better than I imagined. I just wish there were more surfaces that didn't feel like painted MDF in some of the shots. But they did do a decent job of filling it out.
I was impressed with the art direction and not just the sets, but the like what was on the screens seemed not unreasonable to me. Like that they put some thought into what the displays would show and how a working spaceship would display information for its crew. It didn't seem that's always an opportunity to have it be really dumbed down. And in this era, especially of HD TV, you can't just have like a hazy thing and some buttons, right? It's got to be detailed. And I thought they did a good job of that. And then actually for the visual effects, I really appreciated those too. I thought that they looked good and gave me the information I needed about, you know, this is a big spaceship and it's flipping over and it's going to break and that this is a little shuttle and it's going to attach. And I was really struck by, there's a moment where they are fleeing back after they found out that the stealth ship is visible now on their scopes and they need to hightail it back to the Canterbury. They scramble to get back in the shuttle from the ship that they're from the Scopuli that they're investigating. And there's you can see very quickly, it's like a very short shot there, and it's entirely CGI. It is their spacesuits are going up through the little hexagons or something that are connecting the two ships, and it's like the little docking thing for you to get to one to the other. And it struck me because that looks very much like the docking that they use in the movie 2010. And there is a scene that must be at least like 5 minutes. It feels like 10 minutes long, where John Lithgow hyperventilates when he's trying to go from spaceship A to spaceship B. And I just thought it was really funny that here we are 30 years later, and that's a 5 second shot where you see people flinging their way through it. And it's just completely casual, like, yep. And then they went back to the other ship. We're not going to worry about it. It's just, it's routine. But it was it was a spectacular effect. And they, you know, and it was tossed off. It was one of 40 effects that they did in space out there, as opposed to in 2010, where they're like, well, we can show this, but we're going to have to stay there for 5 minutes because we're putting a lot of money into this. So I don't know. That was a thing that I noticed. I liked the space stuff. It felt real to me. I mean, it may not actually. Physicists can drop in and tell us that it was not real, but it felt very realistic to me, and also did impart the information I felt like it needed to about where they were and what was happening.
Yeah, actually, the space stuff was my favorite part of the whole show. I thought it was beautiful, and it had a pretty consistent internal logic, as far as, like you were saying, Jason, with the way things worked. It was elegant, and yeah, so I have no complaints on that score. It was very pretty to watch. I just didn't care what anybody was doing.
Joe, were you going to say something?
I have to nitpick. I was a little disappointed to see some of the lighting choices that they made with, like, filling in the completely dark side of something that's in the asteroid belt miles away from something that would be, like, bouncing light onto the surface of the ship or anything. So it was, like, a little more Star Trek lighting than I would have liked. I would have liked more, I don't know. If you look at something like Europa Report or something like that, as a more modern example of a sort of stark trying to go for realism kind of thing. But the other thing that bothers me is the camera moves. I could have done without many of the flying camera shots that they have put in, especially with following the missiles and stuff, because it's such an incredible speed that it just kind of throws me out when they do that. But that might just be my personal opinion.
I actually had the there's a shot where the Canterbury is flipping, where it does the you know, like, massive pan around to show you that they're stopping, and is that a parallax effect? There's the effect where they're panning around and you can see all the stars swishing around behind it because you're moving. And I thought, okay, well, this is one way to explain that they're doing this flip, but it only goes about halfway and then they cut to the back. And I thought, well, wait a second. Like, if you're going to do that move, I feel like you got to commit to that move and go all the way to the back. And instead, about halfway through, they're like, yeah, we're done. We're just going to show the engines now. Like, no.
You get the picture.
We ran out of money.
Yeah, the rendering.
Halfway through that flip.
It takes a long time to move a camera, especially with a distance like that. So we would have been on that shot for quite some time. And I don't know if it would have felt necessarily very kinetic to spend your time flying around it.
Right.
Which is why they also, like, speed up many of these flying camera moves, where you're going at such an incredible velocity that it seems impractical.
Yeah, I wondered about a couple. There were a couple other interesting shot choices I noticed. One was when they first go on the Scapulae, the rotating camera, which is clearly like a sort of a perspective shift thing, yeah, where it's like, well, because it's space, there is no up and down, so we're like getting the orientation of the ship,
like,
and then
that
we're rotating to fix the rotation. Mm-hmm. That was not bad. I also kind of liked the very claustrophobic close-up shots of the helmets when that one scene where they're in the engine room and they're talking about it.
Oh, yeah. They got the little cameras. The cameras are mounted basically like on their faces there, or right on the helmet, or where the helmet would be, depending.
It wasn't perfectly executed, but it definitely made things feel creepier,
yeah,
and more claustrophobic. So, yeah.
Oh,
you know,
close and personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I thought it was interesting, you know, showing a little bit more dynamism than I think a lot of shows probably would. Like, that could have been done in a less interesting way, which is fine. I don't know. Again, like Joe says, I think, you know, a little goes a long way. So, you know, maybe as long as they're not trying to make every shot totally interesting, maybe that's fine.
Well, yeah, an example of that would be like when we get to Ceres, although we haven't talked about it yet, that first establishing shot where we fly through everything.
Yep.
I did not care for that. I really didn't need to get up close and personal with that air vent.
Now that is, and let's talk about Ceres now. That shot, Joe, that is the shot that reminded me of Babylon 5. It did, and in fact, it reminded me of, I think maybe even the pilot movie of Babylon 5. There is a similar sort of like, let us impress you with our CGI model.
Yeah, you failed, sorry.
And it doesn't work in either place. And actually watching it a second time, what really struck me is that is really important dialogue in explaining sort of the unrest politically that's happening on the belt stations and how the belt doesn't really like supervision from Earth or Mars, frankly. They want to be independent, and as that pan is happening, as that entire CGI shot is happening, we get the dialogue, and there's no way to follow that dialogue if you're watching, because there's so much information on screen as you go through this vent, because and I get what they're trying to do, but I don't think it looks very good. I think it's really distracting. There must have been a better way.
I spent the first half of it trying to be like, is this voiceover? Like, who's speaking?
Right.
Who
yeah.
is telling us yeah. this? Yeah. And I thought that was a bad move on their part. Yeah. It's hard. There's a lot of explication that needs to get done. That was not the way to do it. The explication, I thought, even the text at the beginning, I understand you need to set the scene, but like, there's a lot of information to sort of download. Honestly, the text at the beginning reminded me of nothing so much as the beginning of Hunt for Red October.
That's right.
So, there's a Cold War.
I felt like I had two dialogue based problems when it came to sort of, information. Well, it wasn't really an information dump on the spaceship, but yes, I had the same feeling about flying through the Ceres station and not being able to really follow the dialogue. But then when we cut for the first time to the spaceship and we've got the two guys just before his arm gets slapped off, mm-hmm. and they're talking in their space suits, and there's music, and the music is mixed so high I didn't have subtitles, so mm-hmm. I had real trouble following that dialogue. So whether it was other audio or something visual distracting me, I felt like it didn't do a great job with the execution of introducing me to the new places.
We'll find out when it's aired on Sci-Fi, but I experienced that too, more on the YouTube version than the iTunes version, that I think there was something wrong with the audio mix, and whether it's in it's wrong in the episode or just wrong in what they put online, the dialogue was way too low compared to the rest of the show, I thought.
Yeah, I didn't have that problem, and I only watched the iTunes version.
Yeah, the YouTube version, I found it very hard to follow what was going on and what people were saying.
I did in that. That was the scene that made me turn captions on, though.
Yeah.
Well, I will say, I thought the opening text was fairly well done for what it had to do. I liked how, it would fade out except for the important word in each screen, and you kind of have a little ghost image of that, and it was nice. But at the end of it, I still said out loud, "And they have a plan."
Yeah, by the time we were on the third screen of that, Steven was like, I've already forgotten what they said on the first screen.
there was just too many
screens.
I tried watching it the second time I watched it, which is just before we recorded this. I tried to, if I didn't know what was happening, if I didn't know the books, would I understand a thing that's happening here? And I'm not sure I would. Like, there's just, like we said, there's so much going on, and there's so much that's mentioned or flashed on the screen just like in passing that I don't know. Like, even the first time we watched it, when we're back on Earth, down well, and we see this guy hanging, and I'm like, well, why doesn't he just stand up? And Justin was like, Aline, he's a belter, he can't stand up in the gravity. And I'm like, oh yeah, and I've read the books, I know this stuff.
Finish, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know. There's just a lot, and it's quick.
I'm not... I had that same thing, the same thought of trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody who doesn't know the detail. I do wonder sometimes if knowing the detail of the books plays against that, where you are picking up all the details and know how they're important later, is it really necessary for somebody else to read all that into it, or will they get it as a go? I mean, watching The Wire, the first time especially, you have no idea what's going on. You just kind of go with it, and you get thrown in, and then you figure it out over time. And so I agree that it's going to be challenging for people, because it is hard to pick all that stuff. There's a whole lot of information and a whole lot of setup going on here, but I'm not sure that if all you get out of it is there are these people who had their ship blown up and there's this detective with a hat who is investigating something on a space station.
It's the space fedora.
We get to see it. I think it's not actually a fedora, but I don't care. It's the space fedora.
It's a trilby.
Yeah. So it's a, I think it's
a
pork
trilby.
It's a pork pie in the books.
It's a trilby with trilbies.
It's a pork pie. That may be enough, right? It's like, okay, there's a guy with a hat and there's this and there's they blew up their ship and what's going to happen next. And that may be all you need, but I'm with you, Aline, because we know all the detail. You look at it and you're like, wow, there's a lot of information in there. How is anybody going to unpack it?
Yeah. Well, it feels like it's designed for binging, and it feels like it's designed for watching over and over again. And I happen to think that's a problem with it, a problem with TV in general right now. Alan Sepinwall had a great column the other week about, let episodes be episodes. It's okay. It's sort of like all of these shows are designed now to be an info dump, and you just keep watching. And so even with Jessica Jones, it's like this 13-hour movie where it's just sort of this arbitrary beginning and ending for each episode because it has to be an episode.
Yeah, but I mean, that doesn't really work here. This would have been better almost as a Netflix series where all the episodes dropped on one day.
Well, yeah. But that's what I'm saying, is that this doesn't quite work as a single viewing, as a one-a-week kind of thing. Yeah. And that, I think that's a problem.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be harder for them to find an audience because of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's really going to be interesting to see once they actually start airing it, because they haven't really announced what their plan is for online stuff after they start airing it. Because we all got to see this early because they just randomly put it on the internet one weekend and didn't tell anybody. And so they had it on YouTube, and then they rolled it out to, was it on Hulu? I can't remember. It was on Sci-Fi. It was on iTunes. Then it's going to appear in a two-night thing on the 14th and the 15th, and you're going to get the second episode immediately after on the 15th, which we don't have access to right now. And then I don't really know what their plan is for after that, and I don't know what the internet availability of it will be, whether or not it's going to be on Hulu, whether you buy Season Pass,
It looks like it will be available on Hulu as long as you can authenticate with your TV provider. I'm looking just now because I was curious too. How am I going to watch this?
It's like it's a cable show. It's going to have the usual paths. This is too much for this podcast, but something to talk about at a later time is, they will be challenged on one level because you have to watch it weekly. At the same time, I don't know if you're a TV network, is one of the ways you figure you're going to get an audience that you have to stick with a show. If it's got a decent audience, you stick with it, hoping that once it goes on Netflix, it picks up a new audience, and then they all come back for the next season. Because that has happened with shows before, that it turns out that people discover them, binge through, and then they get back up to where they're watching the regular episodes. But it is a challenge, because I don't think it would be easy after episode one to not watch episode two. I was very excited and wanted to see episode two, and I think it's smart that they're airing it the next night. Mm-hmm. But then what? How does episode two end? We don't know. And will people come back for episode three in a week and accept it being doled out weekly? I think there are only 10 episodes, so it's a short run. It's like the Game of Thrones episodes. It's 10.
Still can't figure out how you fit all this.
Well, let's talk about that in a minute. Before we move on, though, let's talk about the Belt and the Belters and Miller. And we meet Miller, who is a detective. He's got a hat. He's a space detective. He's got a boss who sends him on a mission to find a rich girl, who is Julie Mao, who they want to send back to Earth. Her parents are worried about her, and they want her to be sent on the next shuttle back to Earth. And we know from looking at her, if you look closely, she's the character who's in the very first scene of the show on that ship that the other characters go to investigate and find it abandoned. So you can see how the plot threads should intersect at some point. But also we get to see that he's kind of a mess, Miller is, and he has, there's a scene in a bar where he talks to his, is that his ex-partner to get information about?
I think certainly so. His ex-something.
His ex-something, yes, which is about where would you go if you were a rich girl who showed up on the station, because the implication is that she was that. Maybe this is his ex-wife. I don't know. And she says, eat something, you're a mess. And he's got a partner who's from Earth and doesn't understand what he's seeing. So we sort of see it through his eyes. And you get the sense that he's wise about this stuff. He knows a lot, but he's also very weary and messed up, which is, you know, he's a noir detective in space.
Also, he has a terrible haircut.
He has a terrible faux hawk kind
so
of
bad.
Thing. Yeah.
It's faux hawk comb over.
It's a faux hawk comb over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like comb the Fifth hawk. Element.
That's worst band name ever.
Especially when, you know, this is the future and it's space and air and water are such precious commodities. And when you have like a long kind of greasy do like that, you'd think you'd want to wash it more often. I feel like shorter haircuts would probably be more of a thing on series because you want to keep your hair clean.
Well, that's what the hat's for, maybe.
There's no, it's also for keeping the rain off.
There's also a CGI bird. Who is in the book. Oh. In the book, they talk about that there's a bird that lives in the low gravity, and so they made a little CGI bird that is totally fake.
Think that was a bad choice.
Yeah.
I think conceptually, they just can't pull that off on this budget that they have, and so it didn't. Should have been anything else other than that. When
don't
you're
show
adapting
a bird,
for the medium.
Have a real bird, whatever.
Yeah. Claymation yeah, bird, whatever.
Well, you know, if we had a real bird that was flying around, then it'd be like, well, that doesn't accomplish whatever this gravity thing is that they want to communicate. But that still would have been better and more believable than this, because it's so distracting when you watch it. And it's supposed to be a dramatic moment where he comes to the realization that he's done something horribly wrong. And the whole time you're like, why did you do this? This is not a good bird. Yeah.
Yeah. But he does realize that he shouldn't have let the guy... not change the air filters, I guess. And so he threatens to blow him out the airlock, and then that's something that he does. This is most problematic section of the pilot. Was it is kind of impenetrable because you've got the Belter language, which I think it's interesting that they still try to do that, even though, you know, they can't have everybody be a super elongated no gravity person, but they still try to have them seem kind of alien with and having a speaking an impenetrable language, and that's all fine, and I like the cop in the hat, but I would say that this is the weakest part. Plus, not a lot happens other than scene setting. He gets his assignment, and that's about it.
And I wonder how, you know, because we've got the dude on Earth who we've seen as, you know, tall and thin, as Belters are described in the books. And then we get on the station and we have like these glimpses, like there's the crime scene that we see Miller in, and his partner's looking at the long, thin fingers, you know, this giant, thin hand of a murder victim. And then we have a bunch of people, you know, walking around looking like people, like, you know, Earthers. And I wonder if that's something they should have given up. I wonder if that's a little bit too confusing and weird.
It is addressed in dialogue, right? I mean, they say this is what happens. Everybody's going to look like this eventually, and everybody's got a sign, but some of them are more subtle, and he's got the spurs at the top of his spine or whatever. So
right.
I felt like, I mean, because you can't on a TV budget have a whole bunch of elongated 7-foot people in all of these parts. So instead they sort of like tip their cap at it.
I totally glossed over that. I didn't even, that did not even register as what they were explaining for me there. I was like, I'm not following what's happening. It's all right.
basically, it's two lines of dialogue, and it says, eventually everybody's going to look like this guy, that guy in the bar who comes up to Miller. Everybody's going to look like this guy, but right now there are different people have different ways. There's the guy who's shaking, and he says, you know, that guy that's a reaction to the drugs he's taking to build muscle mass, and you know, everybody who looks like an Earther has something like that, and the tall guy points at the bumps on his neck and says, you know, that's Miller's tell, that he was born in zero gravity or in low gravity. I don't know. I think it's kind of nice that they put it in at all. They could have just not addressed it, right?
Yeah,
and that
right.
might have been simpler to do that and not put in the little reference. But it does add some flavor. It's just not the same flavor as the book.
And I like that they're doing kind of like the pigeon, like the amalgamated language. I did wonder
patois, what... Yeah. Yes, the Delta patois. Mm-hmm.
But when I watched, I was like, do they all have fake Jamaican accents? Like, that's kind of weird. That was an interesting choice.
I was disappointed that Alex, although he is a little down homey, doesn't have the full-on Texan drawl.
He does call everyone Hoss.
He does do that.
Kind of hilarious.
He does do that. It's just I was kind of expecting that it would be a full-on, like, let's rope this cowboy.
Yeah, I kind of wanted a little more southern accent from him.
A little
him.
More Texas.
I could have gotten him a dialogue coach.
Yeah, and a cowboy hat.
And a cowboy hat.
Because there's hats. They got hats on the show.
They got hat more budget is out off this planet.
More hats.
It is off the hat rack.
Any other thoughts about series? This is
I'm looking forward to seeing more of it. There are parts of it. I think the part that they show up top where it's like this is where all the rich people live is kind of dull and terrible CGI. It gets a little more interesting when you get sort of into the asteroid itself and the lower class, the class distinction and stuff like that gets broken down. I think the sets get a little more interesting and the, you know, sort of whole flavor of it comes through a bit more. So I'm intrigued to see as that they sort of flesh that out a little bit more, what it will, if that will start to come through more. I didn't mind the patois as much. I did not find it particularly distracting. I mean, I did have to turn on the subtitles in order to make sure I was getting everything. you know, it was kind of, I like that they're doing that because it definitely has a lot of flavor to it.
Erica?
I agree that this was, with you, Jason, that this was sort of the weakest part of all of it. And I think a lot of it was because of Miller. And he's just, so much TV these days has, you know, the anti-hero jerk character at the center of it. And I'm so sick of that. And that is exactly what they, in this first episode, are showing him to be. You know, he's taking a bribe. He's a drunk. He's not, you know, very nice to his ex exactly. And I didn't really like anything about him. He just seemed kind of like a jerk. And also, I mean, this is kind of another Game of Thrones parallel, is that, you know, there aren't a whole lot of likable people, period, in this. I mean, even Holden just sort of came off as the kind of guy who's trying to shirk responsibility, and I just didn't... I think for me, as a television viewer, I get more invested in the shows where there are characters that I feel like I connect to or root for or can get behind, and... In part, maybe because they were introducing so many characters in this one episode, I didn't feel like I got enough out of any of them to feel like I could root for them. So that's why I am less interested in watching more. Luckily, they gave us a great cliffhanger at the end of this one, so I feel like maybe I'll come back for the second one, and that's going to be the make or break one. But I think Miller on series was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
Yeah, and he's not old enough. Like, he needs to be older.
I feel like from reading the books, I pictured him as not an attractive, rugged, pretty kind of guy. He just, I don't know. Yeah,
I pictured like a early, like mid 50s, early 60s, like really
washed,
weathered.
Up.
Yeah,
he's Dennis Columbo. France. He's Columbo.
Dennis Franz.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you Dennis Franz.
Yeah,
it didn't. I mean,
he's Sipowicz in space.
And I've said nobody will get this, but Dan Morin. But I just pictured our old colleague Dan Miller as Miller.
That's convenient.
Yeah, I can kind of see that.
He's got a beard and bald head, and he's in his his 50s.
He's a little too cheery. A little too cheery.
Well,
to
with the hat on, then he gets serious.
The hat adds 10 years. I mean, no.
But you know, the challenge of it is he is supposed to be a noir detective. He's not supposed to be entirely likable. But you're right. That's a little bit of a challenge with that section.
I just look at him and I see Thomas Jane in Arrested Development. And I think, no, it's not quite right.
I just see the Punisher.
Or Punisher. Thomas Jane in Scott Pilgrim versus the World, where he's the vegan police.
Yeah.
Another police role for him.
I think I have lived a Thomas Jane-free life, largely. So
I have, too. Yeah. This is my first Thomas Jane experience.
You're going to want to be seated for the Thomas Jane experience. Just rotate.
No one will be seated during the dramatic.
And the first few rows will get a little wet.
You might want to trim that one later.
Nope. Just bring the, we got some some bibs over here if you need some
recording.
Recording. Let's fire off the spoiler horn and talk about the books a little bit. How about that? So thank you to everybody out there who is going to turn off now if you haven't read the books and don't want to know about what is to come, because we're going to totally spoil that after the sound of the horn. Goodbye, non-spoiler people. We love you. All right. I read the book after I watched this episode. I reread the book. And
you're insane.
And
when do you sleep?
And here's what I did. I came to the conclusion that I have a hard time seeing how they fit this book into one season.
That seems crazy to me.
I feel like it's a 500-page book. The part that I remember as the gripping climax, it happens halfway through.
Yeah.
And then there's a whole lot of other stuff that happens. And so I didn't map it out exactly, but if they can put that whole book in 10 episodes, I will be shocked. I feel like the final episode has got to be when when the vomit zombies are happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's like a ton left after. I mean, so that's the thing is, like, I was sitting here watching this earlier and I paused at one point to get up to, you know, get something. And I came back and I'm like, there's 14 minutes left in this episode. Like, we haven't even gotten to the freight, like the Scapula yet. We haven't, like, I kept waiting for the, you know, the running and gunning and getting, we haven't even gotten to the Rocinante. And I was like,
yeah,
how are we going to fit this in 10 episodes? That seems ridiculous. It's not often that I say that a series should be longer. I mean, even Jessica Jones, which I really liked, could have benefited from being maybe 10 instead of 13 episodes.
I agree with that. Yep.
But this is one place where I'm like, you guys should have probably put in a 13 episode order. I feel like, I mean, I don't know if you can do this in 10.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Maybe they'll do the Sci-Fi Channel thing where they do in 10 episodes and then they get to, you know, Jason, what you suspected, you know, what you felt like was the climax and the vomit zombies. And then they do a 2-hour, you know, special TV movie to cover off the rest of the book. And then season 2 is book 2.
I don't know how they would do it, but I think if they're already sort of shuffling stuff up from book 2 to sort of give us a little balance, I wouldn't be surprised if they shuffle that to the end and they sort of compress and rearrange a little bit. I don't think it's going to be a direct
adaptation. But the pacing would be really weird. And the pacing's already a little weird.
I think it's going to be, so my gut feeling is that it is going to be very direct. And that although we're going to see the Avasarala stuff where she's basically giving us the perspective on the Earth-Mars relationship as it falls apart, I feel like the most likely scenario to me, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is if I were doing it, I think that the whole thing on Eros, that whole thing, that would be the perfect end for your season, because your characters meet up and then there's a shootout and stuff. And then you've got an entire episode, which is basically this escape from zombies on Eros. That would be a great way to end the season. I don't see how you can get there in 5 episodes, right? Because they have mm-hmm. to get, they have to be on the Martian, they got to be on the Martian warship, which again, all this stuff is good stuff, right? They got to be on the Martian warship that's under attack, and they got to go and then escape on the Rocinante, and then they got to go to Fred at the OPA and meet with him. And
Fred at the OPA.
Fred Johnson, the most.
Go talk to
Fred Johnson. He's got all they're building a ship for the Mormons over there. Just, it's fine. I tried to plot it out and it's like, I don't know how they can do it. Either they drop parts of the book, or better yet, you just, you have season 2, if they are so lucky as to have a season 2, take bits of the, you know, the last part of the first book and maybe parts of the second book and do something there. Cause my recollection is the second book is kind of slack compared to the first book.
There's other stuff that goes, I mean, yeah, it's interesting because each of the books has its own self-contained plot, right? Like, they really do read as, like, if you stack that up against Game of Thrones, I feel like Game of Thrones is, like, you know, it's one book
it's just
continuous, right?
Yeah.
Right? It keeps going. Whereas each of these has, like, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then there's carryover stuff, and there's threads that get picked up. They're more like episodic sequels as far as the books go. So I feel like that is possible, but also tricky, because I feel like the way the pacing works, you'd run out of this stuff by like the middle of the second season.
Well, that's what I was thinking, if season two has the sort of like climax with Miller going back to Eros, and Eros being landing on Venus, basically, right?
Right.
And then the assault on Ganymede and all that stuff with Bobby from the second book.
It feels weird. It feels a little disjointed to me to like start that mid-season. But I understand what you're saying.
They're trying to pull it all together. I mean, having Avasarala on the show, right? They're trying to pull it all in a little bit closer. I don't know. The other thing is, I think about casting, and I think, what do you do with Thomas Jane, who's not present for a book? I don't know.
Yeah, that is tricky, because he's, I mean, you know, I was thinking about it, like, oh, well, they wanted him because, you know, he only gets to do one series, but he has to show up again in Holden's head. So
yeah,
that is dicey. Yeah, that's a weird bit of
straight out of Battlestar
right.
Galactica.
Yeah, yeah.
You got a head Miller.
So who's going to be Bobby?
I don't know. They'll cast somebody next year or the year after, I guess. That'll be a fun one.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a great character. I love that character.
I do too.
Maybe they'll drop. I mean, I feel like, you know, you could kind of drop, if you wanted to drop something, some of the plot from book two. You're right that, like, I don't know, like even chasing the kids around sometimes feels like it's maybe potentially extraneous, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the fun thing is, I am sure that the producers, including the two writers, broke this all down, right, and figured out the way through. And we have to wait and see what they did. But right. Just my gut feeling is that set of set pieces on Arrow Station as it goes to hell and they expose all the people to radiation and they become zombies is a fantastic season ender, or
yeah.
if you want to look at it another way, a fantastic penultimate episode in the style of Game of Thrones or The Wire,
like a denouement.
Yeah, and then they get out of there and
yeah, I would be, episode 9. Yeah, I think that the pacing wise, that works really well as a penultimate episode where you can get some time to unravel stuff after that,
and then maybe season 2 becomes an interesting amalgamation of the end of book 1 and part of book 2. I don't know. I think on the positive side of doing a book a year is, I think the sooner they get to, especially somebody like John Siracusa, who says, there's no expanse, where's the, it's not expansive, that the faster you get to alien probes flying around and setting up stargates, the better.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Sorry, Erica, that is a spoiler for future books. The thing that the protomolecule creates when it goes to Venus is like basically it makes a stargate, and that's part of, and it's like, where did this come from and where does it go? And it does expand. It becomes much more expansive.
If James Spader doesn't show up, I'm not interested.
I like a lot of the intrigue stuff, though, and that's why, you know, I like the Avasarala stuff in book 2. So, you know,
yeah.
I understand that, yeah, from a sci-fi perspective, that sort of pushes the envelope a little bit more, but I wouldn't want to gloss over too much of the sort of political intrigue and stuff.
I agree.
Because I really enjoy all that.
It's also a lot cheaper.
Yep.
Plays well on TV.
And it's really important when we come to the expanse, you know, you know, is there, you know, the great push to colonize other planets, you know, it's really important. These Mars Earth interactions really play into some later books. I think in important ways that, I think we can lose a lot if that's not done and not explained well.
Yep. I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like Eric is saying, we didn't really have a lot of character time in this, but, you know, it's eventually going to become all about these characters, and if we just cut all of the stuff that's the politics and the intrigue, that would just be...
I agree.
So terrible.
Yeah, you don't want to just be a plot engine, right? Like,
No, and it's not practical. I mean, it is. I can joke about it being cheaper, but it's also not practical budget-wise to just have... Let's just do space battles and action set pieces, right? You can't. In fact, Avasarala coming up into season 1 helps them get that balance sooner, which I think is good and lays groundwork for what she does in season 2 or book 2 or whatever, by having her be present from the beginning. The writers probably regret not having her be present in the first book, she would have been, you know, maybe a little extraneous, but now as a series, it makes sense to have her there. Mm-hmm. So it's good for the characters. It's good for the political story. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Game of Thrones is it's about the politics and how they interact.
I am a little concerned though, just from a production standpoint, like if they end with Eros, and that's going to be the big deal. I just don't know, based on how we saw them flesh out Ceres, I just don't know how they're going to get like the scope of Eros and like running around all these big empty corridors and evacuated people and casinos. And I'm not 100% sure how it's going to work out.
They'll do another fly through.
If we fly through air vents again, and it's just like, we're turning on the radiation switch now as a voiceover, I'm just going to lose it.
I am really interested. So one of my gripes with the books was the slow character development of women. It's like Naomi's kind of there as just like whatever. You know, you can tell she's smart and she's important. And
it takes many books for us to get her story.
Yeah. And that, like, I kept figuratively throwing my books as I was reading because I'm like, I want Naomi's perspective on things. And I think it would be nice if we could see the importance of women a little bit faster in this series than we do, like, in the books.
Well, and they have the benefit of hindsight, right? Like, because they know all this now, right? Like, they don't have to write it. It's already there in the books, so you can dribble that out as you go along.
So one of the interesting things about the series is that they also do these novellas based on it. And I did read an article that said that there's stuff in, I think they said episode 5, that is from The Butcher of Anderson Station.
Okay. Hmm.
So that's an example where presumably they're going to go meet Fred Johnson. Fred the IPA.
Johnson.
That's right. Behind it is the most generic name. That used to be my go-to generic name for it's like, it's, you know, let's go talk to Fred Johnson. And that's the name of the guy. But they do go to him. He's the Butcher of Anderson Station. It sounds like they're going to do a flashback and actually tell part of that story. And that's interesting because that's showing some angles that aren't in the book but are in the universe that they know about. And so maybe there's some of that with Avasarala as well. It wouldn't, you know, depending on how the casting is and when what the timeline of the series is, could we see Bobby earlier than we see her? I don't know. I mean, she's supposed to be just a grunt on Ganymede, I guess. But, you know, I don't know. It will be interesting to see what they do. I do think that Avasarala is partially pulled forward because the cast it's just too male. And that's a great character. She's your breakout character. She doesn't appear until book 2. And it gets you another woman in the cast. It's like, why would you not do that? And then you cast Shore Agashlu as Avasarala? Yeah, okay, do that. Do that now.
Yeah. And I will say, like, my gripes with the first couple of books are largely resolved in the later ones. And I think that they're really from a diversity standpoint, because that's what I have to talk about. But they're getting a lot better. And I really appreciate that about the book. So if people, you know, if you're listening and you're like, I read the first book and like it made me mad because there weren't women and people. Right. One gripe I had was that. It seemed like they always pointed out when a character was black and they never mentioned race otherwise. Mm-hmm. I remember a news anchor. This news anchor is an obese man with ebony skin. And I'm like, and then there was this other dude and he did things. And that made me really upset. And they're not doing that. They're not doing that I've noticed now. So they're getting better about those kinds of things. So if that was a turnoff for you, the stories are really good. And I'd encourage you to give the rest of the books a chance, because I think that especially with book 2, we have Bobby, we have our salty government official, and just like give it a chance, because they are both, I think, amazing characters. I know others disagree about Bobby being amazing, but I think that she's phenomenal.
Others disagree. I love Bobby. She's a big, beautiful black Marine who kicks ass. How great is she?
Right. Yes.
Well, she's Samoan. But
oh, is she Samoan? Well,
she's
sorry.
Samoan.
All my characters are black. You're right. She's Samoan. She's from Mars, but she's Samoan. She's a giant Samoan Marine.
All they ever do is talk about how big she is, and every time they introduce her, she's like, "Oh," and then Bobby with her rippling muscles picks up. And it's just like, "Okay, I got
she's big.
It."
Yeah, don't screw that large. Up, guys.
Even her family thinks she's big. Even in her stupid cousin who gets into trouble in that one novella that is not that interesting, except that it's got Bobby in it.
Yeah,
that's what kept Bobby me from reading the other novellas. I picked up The God of Risk and I started that, and I was just like, what is happening? Yeah. There is nothing happening.
The Amos one is pretty good.
Yeah,
actually.
That one's good.
Okay.
Yeah, read that one.
Aline, you may have just talked me into reading the second book, which I was I was on the fence about.
Yeah, no, I strongly encourage you to give it a chance.
They progress. They do.
The second book is my favorite of the five.
Interesting.
Yeah,
that's a good one.
I really hate book three.
Maybe that's the one I didn't like. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, you it has its moments, but yeah, book four for me was kind of the weak point. But they,
Have the TV show itself is really kind of an interesting thing to have when you are the creators of the book being involved in the creation of the show, the ability to sort of, as you were saying, kind of like, you know, fix some of the things that they didn't learn until later and sort of fill in some of the holes. So I will be interested to watch whether I read the second book or not and just see and hear from you guys what the differences are and if they actually learned stuff and did make those fixes.
Well, and let's give them some credit too. They are trying very hard in the book to portray a diverse solar system. Mm-hmm. They definitely do a better job as they go along. But the whole idea is that they are trying from the characters that they draw and the descriptions they make of the various ethnicities in various places. I would say more about race than about gender, but they try to do that where they explain that they're telling a story that is more diversity of characters than some of the classic science fiction novels that I have read. Let's put it that way.
The fact that they get better is also, I mean, kind of a really cool thing because that shows that they're willing to, you know, just sort of listen to criticism probably coming in from the readers and the audience and stuff. And instead of getting defensive and pushing back and being like, no, I made it diverse in the first place, they actually expanded. And so if it does really get better, yay for them. I think that's fantastic and shows that they're open-minded.
The four main cast members, the four members of the crew, it's a woman of Asian and African descent, a guy of Indian descent, the guy from Baltimore that I was convinced was black but apparently isn't, and Holden, who is a white guy, but he's a white guy from a group marriage of parents.
That's true.
So there's a lot of interesting stuff in this group and their backgrounds that that is interesting. So I think they were trying hard for it, but I agree with Aline that, like, Naomi is a great example where she's a strong character from the beginning as a strong person with a point of view, but she doesn't get her moments for a while.
Yeah, like when I read the second book, I was like, okay, I'm ready to read about Naomi. I'm ready to, and it didn't come, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And I read the third book, and I was like, okay, it's time to get Naomi's point of view. And I don't think we got it in the third book either. And it wasn't until like the fourth and fifth books that it's finally like, oh, here's some Naomi. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. If I had been reading along the whole time, I might have given up instead of, you know, binge reading them all, you know, the first four books and then waiting a little bit for the fifth one.
I was actually kind of frustrated with the fifth book because I was reading it. It was just like, you had all of this backstory about her and for four books.
Yeah. I didn't super love her backstory either, but
no,
there was a lot of Naomi. So, am I going to do?
It felt like that. I wish we had seen more of that sooner. And that they're like, oh, geez, we never told you anything about Naomi. Well, she doesn't like to think about her past. I'm like, okay, but, you know, you wait until it's absolutely necessary for the plot, and then you drop her entire history on us. I would have liked to have seen that sooner. Yep. So, well, all this left to go. Hopefully this will go well, and then there will be more of it, because the book series I like a lot. And like I said, unlike George, they continue to produce books one a year.
You might say that the Game of Thrones is a bit like The Expanse, but in medieval times.
No, I wouldn't.
You might. No. You might, though.
No.
Maybe.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, but you might.
All right, well, we're gonna close up the old podcast. What do you think, though? The real question is going to be, are we going to come back and talk about other episodes at some point? I don't know. What do you think?
I'm game.
I hope so.
Yeah, well, if the second episode's any good.
All right, there you go.
Or maybe if it isn't.
Make no promises.
And I'm not doing is committing to doing one of these every week for every episode. But if we don't do that, then maybe we'll come back and check in every few episodes and see how we're feeling about it.
Yeah, also there's 10. So if we had like one that capped it all off at the end, then I wouldn't be like the worst thing in the world.
That's true. That's
true.
That
would be the worst thing in the world, Joe. The worst.
I'm also coming off of literally just having done done 12 straight weeks of Doctor Who. So it's like, yay, yep, more TV podcasts every week. Maybe take a little break, but it's The Expanse. I'm excited. So
this year, that wasn't work.
It's still, this is inside baseball. It's still every Saturday having to line up guests and do a podcast. So that can cramp your calendar a little bit. You know, I'm the one who has to tell my wife, well, I can't do that thing that you would like to do because at 2 o'clock I have to talk about Doctor Who. So
I'm committed to talking to people on the internet.
About nerd TV. Yeah, exactly.
Well, my TV cast is about to go on hiatus, so I got nothing but time.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll all check in. We're the Legends of Television here. DC's Legends of Television.
Oh, wait. Are we going to do that one too?
Somebody's probably going to have to do that one.
Someone just slaps David.
All right. Thanks to everybody out there for listening to this interesting, lengthy thing about the first episode of The Expanse.
Those
who are still out here. And don't forget to check out The Expanse on Sci-Fi, and episode 2 is the day after episode 1, so you won't have to wait too long. Goodbye!